You may have noticed our new branding and our fabulous new website, thestagelessepodcast.com. Well, as musicians, do you ever finish your song, EP, album, really happy with what you created, but think, what now? What's next? What visuals suit the work I've created? What about the graphic design? Or even worse, you hire a photographer who you spend money on, but they don't quite land the vibe you're going for. Well, the answer is Who's Hughes, which is run by the creative genius that is Bastien Hughes, who is a brilliant musician in his own right and will take your nuanced story and create a vision around it. Such a clever process that Bastien has designed and really is the answer to your kind of what's next question. So if you head to bastienhughes.com, that's bastienhughes.com, or Instagram, Bastien Hughes. The first five people who mention Stage Left will get a free branding consultation session with him, which I cannot tell you, you know, how valuable that stuff is, really. So do go over to bastienhughes.com, because many, many times we get sucked into a world of doing take after take or endlessly tweaking mixes for our work of art we've created, and then just think, well, what's next? What now? Well, bastienhughes.com is your answer, because it's a safe, trusted pair of hands for the next stage of your work of art.
Take a while to change the culture. I see, like, going to watch a band is starting to become more of a thing that a group of girls will do.
There's also making the spaces safe for women and making women feel safe when they go to a gig. And I would just like it to be more of a culture where girls go together to watch a band. And I think getting more girls being in bands, playing music, is a start as well.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, Beyoncé, The Beatles, Gorillaz, Radiohead, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Guns N' Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Today we bend our rules a tad for the returning Louisa Roach, who stands front and centre in all things She Drew the Gun, who appeared on Stage Left in 2018 on the eve of the release of Revolution of Mind, which went on to huge critical acclaim and actually resulted in playing our Stage Left Nights event, where Louisa treated eight lucky people to performance in our lounge and was one of the most magical nights of my life, to be honest. Today, Louisa returns on the eve of the release of She Drew the Gun's third album, Behave Myself, and we'll be discussing the origin of key songs on the album one by one, plus charting the highlights and lowlights of the past 3 years, which has included not being able to play live due to COVID. We'll be shining a light on equality in the music industry and what needs to change. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Louisa from She Drew the Gun. Thanks for joining us today, Louisa. How's it going?
Hi, Chris. Yeah, it's going good. It's nice to be back.
It's good.
Thanks for the intro.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you on. And it's really interesting. I listened back to the interview we did in 2018, and you said in that interview that working to deadlines helped the process of the second album. So in the first album, you didn't really work to deadlines. The second time you did. Did you have any deadlines for this one, and how was it impacted by COVID?
So it was kind of like didn't feel like there was any deadlines, because it was like it was just lockdown, and it was like, what the hell, what is the future? Do you know what I mean? It was like, it was just a bit of limbo kind of thing. And then it was, and for ages I didn't write anything. I think I was just like kind of absorbing what was going on. But then at some point, once like things had kind of settled in a little bit, I did start writing. And then it was all really laid back, because it was like, oh, we don't know when there's going to be an album coming out, anything like that. And then all of a sudden it was like, yeah, we've got tour dates and you're going to do it and you need the album finished. So it was like, oh my God. So it went from being like no deadline at all to being like deadline, like quite a fast deadline. So.
And how many songs did you write for the whole process? So, because, you know, if you look at So when Michael Jackson recorded Thriller, great album, 9 tracks on there, but he recorded like 130 tracks or something like that beforehand and then chose the best 9. Like how, because it's so prolific, this album. It's like, there's so many great songs on it. Did you record like tons of songs or come up with tons of ideas, or are they just the kind of 11 or 12 that you came up with?
I had like 12 demos. So, and then it was like, okay, we've got an album's worth there. So that was when we started looking at starting to record. And then I think we might have finished another demo when we'd actually started recording, because the recording process happened over months. So we went for a first like little tester recording session to see how it went, and it went well. And then we'd go back, and this was after the studios were allowed to be open again. We'd just go back in for 4 days and then come back, and then like the next month we'd go back in for another 4 days. So it wasn't all recorded in one session. It was like over a period of months. But yeah, as soon as I had 12 songs, I mean, we'd made 12 demos, that was when we were like, yeah, let's start recording. So I didn't like have loads of spare stuff, because I think I was just quite happy with, I think there was a few demos that were just kind of disregarded and went, yeah, I don't think that's going to make the album, it doesn't fit with this body of work. But I think once I had like that 10 or 12 songs that I was happy with, I was like, yeah, we've got an album in there somewhere, so let's go with that.
And it's interesting you say about they don't fit in this body of work. Again, listening back to the previous interview talking about the second album, you said that you consciously thought, okay, what do I want the finished thing to sound like before you actually kind of recorded it? Did that differ this time, or was it the same? And why did those particular songs not fit in this body of work? What is this body of work compared to those other songs?
Yeah, I think it's quite like, it's a little bit of a dark body of work. It's a little bit of a, there's like a kind of, you can tell it was like a lockdown, or there was some kind of form of like imprisonment, or there's I think over the album there's like 7 mentions of either the word prison or cell or cage. There's like that recurring theme of being locked in or trapped, you know, that kind of idea. So it's like a darkness to the album that I think wasn't there in other demos. And not that the whole album, not that it's a sad album, because I think it's got like an underlying kind of message of hope and kind of seeing the world for what it is and stuff like that. But like, yeah, I don't know, there's a certain kind of vibe about it. It's a vibe.
It's so interesting that. So I wrote down in my notes, so you very kindly let me have a quick listen to the album, and I felt that the most important line of the whole album was, now I see the bars of this cage. And which is really interesting that you pulled that out as well. And so what is the cage? And what do the bars look like?
I think the cage is kind of seeing that the way that everyone tells you that the world is good and it's fine and just carry on going about your work, you know, be a good hard worker. Yeah. I think the bars is like recognising the forms of oppression that are going on in the world, really, and the things that keep people in their place and how all these things are interwoven. I think it's recognising oppression in all its forms, and that's like an ongoing battle, because it's not made clear to you. You know, when you grow up as a person in this world, it's not something that is laid out to you. It's something that you've got to kind of recognise. So that's why it's like, now I see the bars of this cage, because it's not something that is going to be made apparent to you unless you dig a little further, unless you read what people are saying, unless you, you know, do your own research or read great poets, read good authors, kind of, I don't know, open your eyes to kind of what's going on, because it's very easy to just ignore what's going on in the rest of the world as well.
I am the rage of all women condensed to the point of explosion. I'm the silence of violation finally broken. I am the joke behind the eloquent feminist slogan, and I will not behave myself. I am the cheap labor and the overpriced beauty promotion. I'm the time bomb of pathological consumption approaching. I'm the child of Mother Earth and the dirt in her ocean, and I will not behave myself.
That line comes from the title track of the album, which repeatedly you say, I will not behave myself. Why behave myself as the album title? And what you know, when you're choosing these things, it's, you know, you must run through 100 different album titles. Why that one? Why did that jump out to you?
I did like really like Now I See the Bars of This Cage as an album title. And if it was if it was like a book, it'd probably be that. That'd probably be it. But I think you maybe... it's better to be a bit more snappy with an album title. And Behave Myself, kind of like, it's probably the strongest song on there. Probably captures the kind of spirit of the album, like unshakable heart, unstoppable chain. It draws in all the stuff, even like Panopticon is like, a Panopticon is all about and making people behave themselves through self-surveillance. So
Panopticon, because it's really interesting, I had to Google what that word meant, and I kind of found it. So is it a type of prison that was used so that people could be observed but they can't see that they are being observed? Is that right?
So it was like this guy Jeremy Bentham, I think his name is, he was like an inventor and a philosopher, and he invented this. The idea of it is that there's like, you only need a single person in the watchtower because the people don't know whether they're being watched or not, so they will like behave themselves. They will change their behavior because they could be being watched at any time. And then it's kind of like a bit of a metaphor for like the modern kind of surveillance state that we live in. I love like a double meaning or a metaphor, or if there's, you know, a bit of depth to something, then that's why that ended up being one of the tunes. And Panopticon is just, it's a bit abstract, it's a bit out there, but it's probably the most abstract part of the album, and it's the most like dancey part of the album as well. But I feel like all these themes kind of go together.
Yeah, totally. And where does Next on the List sit with that then? Because is that a Next on the List as to who's kind of been going to be thrown under the bus kind of by the government processes, or like is that what the Next on the List is? Because it's really interesting, obviously you list a lot of, you know, oppressed groups throughout that song. Is that where that's coming from?
It's like it's a list of groups that have been othered by the status quo, by the mainstream, to like be blamed for like the downfall of society kind of thing. And then the song is kind of questioning like, who's going to be next on the list? Could it be you? Could it be the group that you're in next on the list? You know what I mean? Who else are we going to keep on othering and pushing to the outside of society to make the middle feel better? Because it's I think it's like a form of control to like to other groups of people to make it seem like they're inferior, to kind of satisfy those that are in the middle, that kind of to kind of justify privilege, I suppose.
It's interesting because we spoke about last time about change and what needs to change. It's actually in Behave Myself, you say, as you just quoted there, you talk about unstoppable change. But obviously, what is that unstoppable change at the moment, and what continues needing to be changed?
I think the unstoppable change is like there's constant ruptures in this idea that everything's okay. There's people protesting somewhere now in the world. There's people, it's constantly happening, and then you get these mass movements like the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter movement, you know, things that catch and turn into a bigger thing, and it's going to take these groups of movements to all come together. And that's the unstoppable change for me. Like, that's this rebellion, this fight against what's happening, because I mean, I think it's come to the point now, it's like, we're either going to save capitalism or we're going to save the planet. So it's like, how how long is it going? How long are we going to let the 1% like systematically destroy the living environment of everyone else? And people are standing up against it. It is hard. I think it's hard because it's also very easy to just not think about any of that and to just go and escape in whatever culture's got to offer. But I think these movements are always happening. There is always these things going on beneath the surface that are coming up to the surface at times. And yeah, that's what the unstoppable change is. These oppressions that have been going on for centuries that cannot possibly continue forever.
You talk about going on for centuries there, going a bit further than that. The opening track, Origin Song, it's kind of like about our evolution and it's got great vibe to it, great tune. Really interesting because you've told us before that you bang into like science fiction and a hook line in that is like empires return to the earth. What are the empires? Is it the kind of things like the British Empire, et cetera, or is it the Empire from Star Wars, basically? Like, what's the Empire's return to the earth?
Civilizations, I think. So I think it's basically asking the question, will our civilization, will we change, or, you know, will we change? It's like in blood or in gold. So what will we value? Will we value human life or will we value gold and money? And will we continue? Will we live or will our civilization return to the earth and leave space for the next, whatever happens, whatever thing evolves after we're gone? Because it's scarily like close that could happen. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's a question song, and the whole song in its entirety is, it starts with the Big Bang and it ends at the revolution. So it's, I suppose there is a little bit of sci-fi in it because it's the future a little bit into the future, the end of the song anyway.
Another song that's been played a lot at the moment, Class War, which I literally can't get out of my head at the moment, particularly like particularly the call and response, you know, like the Class War, that's always just like jumping about in my head at the moment, which is great. I love the fact that obviously you've got in Sexing Up the Facts, which is obviously a reference to Alistair Campbell, you know, Weapons of Mass Destruction, etc., etc. Tell us about the origin of that song and, you know, how that song came about and recorded.
So a lot of the songs like have been started off on like, just went into the garage, put GarageBand on and got the drummer, GarageBand drummer just playing. And that was one of these ones that I just put the drummer on and then I started playing the bass line and then I was like, I don't know, just like a bit of a melody started coming and then I just thought it was quite like obvious. I thought it was a bit too like crass in a way just to go class war because it's like there's no like subtlety to it. There's no like... It was just very, like, very plain, lyrically. It was quite earnest and that. So I thought, part of me was, like, dismiss that, but then I thought, no, just go with it. And just thought, like, obviously it's just a reaction to what's going on with politicians. Like, this, it's just so brazen, like, the amount of corruption that's going on. They're just, like, paying themselves ridiculous amounts of money, just handing out contracts to the mates. Just everyone's... They're just ripping us all off so badly. So it was just like, why not just say it exactly as it is? So the idea is, like, someone's going... It's the person saying, how much did you get paid for that? Really, that's meant to be the politician... not the politician, the journalists. That's meant to be the journalists that are asking the question. So how much are you getting out of this? Do you know what I mean? They should be asking that question all the time. But the only people that do ask those questions is, like, left-wing media. So it's like, or it's like, also it's like the people we should be asking. So how much exactly are you getting out of this? And I don't know, because the media don't lead that way, the people kind of become apathetic to it. So you've got
and distracted as well,
and
right?
Very much distracted, yeah. And then, yeah, this, the idea of, like, I think I was reading Mark Fisher, and it was like, he talks about collective consciousness and stuff, and how it has to be continually suppressed. Like, you know, we do live in, like, a situation where they are suppressing it. The right wing does control the mass media. And this collective consciousness that we've got is being suppressed all the time. And that kind of makes me think, well, I don't know, you know, how many people are listening or whatever, but at least I can be someone who's saying, well, I can see through it, and putting my hand up and going, I can see it. And, you know, if anyone else is feeling like they're the only ones, or, you know, they want to connect with someone else who feels like that, then I can be there doing that, if you know what I mean.
And what you're talking about is so common as well. So it's, and it's right, if anyone's listening to this and doesn't realise, like, some of the stuff, you know, that Louise is talking about, like, please, you know, even just you saying that triggered my memory that, like, so I'm from a place called Romford in Essex, which is kind of traditionally, like, sort of the earth, very working class area. And there's, like, a Tory politician there. And last week, so what you just said there triggered my memory that, like, it was in the last 2 weeks, it's been reported that this kind of sort of the earth, you know, it's a guy supposedly claimed more than £125,000 in second home expenses last year. Like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, £125,000. And that's just one example of just so many, like, kind of other examples there are out there, you know, while still claiming to be, oh yeah, you know, my mum still lives in Romford, you know, and just, yeah, you know, would think of this guy as, like, oh, one of us. It's like, no, he's not. No, he's not at all. Like, not, you know, it's just, it's incredibly frustrating. Another song I'd, yeah, love to dive into, probably my favourite song on the album, All Roads to Nowhere. What a beautiful song. Tell us about that, where that came about, and the lyrics behind that one, if you're happy to.
Yeah, well, that one is, like, there's always, like, a sci-fi protest song, isn't there, on a She Drew the Gun album? And that, this is that one, because it's just, it's set in the near future, in, like, a dystopian near future, not too dissimilar to where we are now. So the first verse is just, like, kind of about how bad mental health, basically, and wanting to escape to the end of a bottle or whatever else might take you away from the immediacy of your feelings. And then the second verse, like, looks at the landscape that the person is in and kind of turns it into a comment on how neoliberalism affects your mental health, and that it's, you know, not just an individual problem, it's a societal, there's a lot of societal issues that go into people's mental health. And then the third part, so it's like a three-part song, so there's the two verses and then the last part, the massive outro part, is about questioning yourself whether you're gonna give up the fight, or whether you're gonna, you know, dig in and find the strength to fight. So yeah, that's kind of that's that song.
The near future dystopian kind of vision that you have on that song, how does it complement the near future dystopian vision on Paradise from the last album? Because I know that was a similar kind of thing. Are they the same place? Are they in a different timeline? Are they, how does, you know, do they complement each other? Because an interesting one.
Yeah, I think Paradise was like kind of like, I always think of that as like a really, a like cheesy 50s advert for capitalism. So that is more of a comment on capitalism. I think, I suppose I'm just always like doing little comments on the, you know, systems that we live in, just trying to find different angles and stuff, just come from different angles to do it. So a lot of it is there to don't know, ask questions and poke holes.
Well, I'm about to get upset from watching my TV, checking out the news until my eyeballs fail to see. I mean to say that every day is just another rotten mess. When's it gonna change, my friend, is anybody's guess. So I'm watching and I'm waiting, hoping for the best. Think I'll even go to praying every time I hear them saying that there's nowhere to delay that trouble coming every day. Nowhere to delay that trouble coming every day.
This is Gem Archer and you're listening to the Stage Left Podcast.
Fucking
follow us on Instagram at the Stage Left Podcast, where you'll see behind the scenes photos from our interviews with members of Oasis, Queen and Madness.
The year before last, you released Trouble Every Day on EP, and I remember when I heard that on Six Music, I was like, how do I know that song? I really recognised that song, and it was like a new song. And I checked my phone, and when you played Our Night, or Stage of Night, you played it, I think you said, for the first time. And so that's where I recognise from it. It's an absolute tune. Do you ever, I've always wondered this with artists who release EPs and then an album a year later. Why make that decision then? And is there part of you that just thinks, oh, I kind of wish I'd save that and put that on the album, because it might kind of get lost in time. Like, people might not discover it as much as they might do on an album.
I think, a lot of what you do is also dependent on your timeline, what's going on with your live stuff. And I think the decision to do an EP was based around, we'd sold out the first tour. We'd sold out the tour for the original tour for the album, and we could book in another tour. So we just put the EP out to coincide with that, just to have some activity around that. But I felt like it worked as an EP, and I think enough time had passed to move on to a new kind of thing with this new album. And now I feel like, you know, the EP wouldn't really fit in. The stuff on the EP wouldn't really fit in with the album. I feel like we've moved on. We've progressed into a different part of the journey. Like, I don't know what'll happen after. Like, I don't know which way. I feel like the road's quite open to which way we could go next. And I've not thought about that yet, and I'm not writing or anything at the moment. I'm just like working with what I've got, just like looking forward to the album coming out early, and then making the live show really good. But yeah, I think I feel like we've reached a new like little base camp on the mountain with this new album. Like, it's gone a bit somewhere else.
Louisa, what was the first concert you ever went to, or first gig you ever went to?
It was Oasis at Main Road.
Really?
Yeah.
What a baptism. What do you remember of that night?
So me and my mates, we were like 15 or 14, I don't know. It was 15, I think. So I was just there in the full Adidas trackie. We got there dead early. As soon as they opened the doors and they let people in, it was like people were stopping to buy programmes and stuff, and I was like, okay, I need to see what's going on first. Ran up to the top of the stadium, and I could see, like, we were like really early, like there was hardly anyone there, so started running, ran down and got into the front pen, you know, where it's like you get a wristband and it's like you're like, I don't know how many people's in the front pen, maybe it was like 500 or something like that. So got down, got a wristband for the front pen, and then I was on the second row. So yeah, I can't remember who was supporting. I don't know, it might have been like a Beatles cover band. But anyway, as soon as Oasis came on, I got dragged underneath. As soon as the crowd started moving, and I was just dragged underneath, and then I had to get pulled out and go to the St. John's ambulance and hyperventilate into a paper bag.
No way, really?
Yeah. But then they let me back out again, and then I had my wristband to go back in the front pen, so I was like dead chuffed. So that was fine.
Yeah, do you know what? Funny enough, my mate still wind me up about this. It wasn't one of my first concerts, but when I saw Aces at Wembley Stadium in, I think it was 2000, a similar thing happened. Happy Mondays were supporting, and I'd never been in a crowd like that. And they started to Step On, and then it just felt like this wave of people. And you know me, like I'm 5'6", like I just got completely like lost. And like, yeah, I just went had a full on panic attack. Didn't quite make it to St. John's Ambulance, but I was just like, I'm just going to stand at the side now. So I feel your pain there. If you think about your own gigs that you've played in the past, what's one gig or concert you've played that you wish you could go back and experience from the audience perspective?
Oh my God. All of them. I'm probably forgetting stuff. I think, oh God, why is it that hard? Should know what my favourite gigs are, shouldn't I? I think on the first tour we did with Revolution of Mind, which was sold out everywhere, loved that tour. I think I really loved the London show.
Is that the Garage?
Yeah, the Garage.
Yeah, I was there for that, so I could just tell you what it was like from the audience perspective in that case. It was banging night. It was great.
Yeah, I think we might have had issues with the sound there. We've got a new sound engineer now as well, so that's good. I think when we played the John Peel last time at Glastow, that was really cool. I'd like to have seen that from an audience perspective because everyone I know there was crying.
Wow.
I could see like my friends in the audience crying and stuff, so it must have been all right. Yeah, I can't think right now, but
there was a lot of goodwill for you at the Garage show. I specifically remember that. I specifically remember speaking to other people there, and it was absolutely rammed as well. It's like it's a big place, you know, particularly like only on a second album. To like, as you say, it was sold out. And yeah, I just remember, I don't remember the sound issues from out front. Like I remember it just sounded great. Everyone looked confident. Yeah, it was a special night. It was definitely a special night. And yeah, I was also thinking you might say the Union Chapel show, because you play the Union Chapel as well, right? That's a lovely venue.
The Union Chapel? The church one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really nice venue. And it was the Stand Up For Cancer gig, so that was nice, but it wasn't my best gig, I don't think. Yeah, I think I've had better. I don't know.
What
I
happened?
Think we did like... No, I didn't forget the words, but I started off like slightly wrong in my key because sometimes when you can hear too much bass, it sends you on the wrong. It's not happened many times, but I started off in the wrong kind of key, so that kind of puts you off.
The reason I say about forgetting words, and I hope you don't mind me sharing this, but there was a great moment when you played Our Night where you'd only just obviously started playing Something For The Pain a few times and you forgot the words, stopped the song. I pulled them up on my phone and all I could find was Something For The Pain by Bon Jovi, which then they were there requests to play Something For The Pain by Bon Jovi. Okay, if the world ended tomorrow, you found out the world was ending tomorrow, what would be your biggest regret musically? What would you think, damn, I never got around to doing that, or I should have found time to do that?
Ooh, that's a tough question. It'd probably be some kind of song that I haven't written. It'd probably be something that I haven't written about, because I don't think there's any like opportunities that I've not taken up that I've had the opportunity to do. So I'm just like hoping for more opportunities going forward. I think one thing that we are missing is a really great live video. Cause I think we need to do like our own. Like we could do with a live session and recording it so that it kind of shows where we're at live and stuff like that. So
get it on the to-do list.
Yeah.
For this upcoming tour. Next question I had for you was around, you know, often, you know, artists will write a song and in their mind they've got this song and they have an idea of what it's going to sound like. And then the finished product, you just think, I didn't quite turn out as I wanted to, and like you kind of feel like it's wasted. Is there any song that you ever recorded that you think, I wish I could go back and re-record that and nail it even better? Because that is quite a common thing.
To be honest, I'm quite critical, so I'd probably do quite a lot of them. It's and like with hindsight, it's like easy to change things, but when you have got to do things on time and there's always like some compromises that you've got to make with whoever's producing it, whoever's mixing it. There's always compromises and stuff like that. I've just got to, like, if I start thinking about the things that I want to re-record and stuff like that, I probably get sad. So I think it's, like, I think you've just got to, like, be happy with what you've got and move on, I think. There's a certain element of that you've got to do that. And then hope one day that you can go back and get them remastered or something, you can do what you want with them.
I think that's where a producer helps, right? So that's where the producer says, right, enough. Like, that's it. No more edits. We're not doing anything more. That's you know, enough's enough. So did James Skelly produce this new album? Because I know he's been involved in previous stuff. How was who produced this? Was it self-produced or?
No, it was Ross Orton. So he did the Arctic Monkeys and most recently did Working Men's Club. He's done The Fall. He's worked with a lot of bands. He's like, I think because there's quite a lot of dance stuff in the album, and there's guitar stuff as well. It was like someone who's done the dance world, which he has, and also, you know, can record guitars. He's done like Drenge and stuff like that. He's done obviously Arctic Monkeys, and so it was like he's definitely got the experience to have done everything that we needed.
And what's his particular, it'd be interesting to see, like, compare his, like, production techniques compared to others, people you've worked with. Is there anything that he did particularly that you thought, oh, that really got the best out?
Well, he's very hands-on, so he does everything. He does everything in the shoot, like, he works hands-on with all the machinery and everything. And he's a really, really nice guy. I've been lucky with whoever I've worked with as a producer. I think we were able to use his experience and his ability, especially on the dancey stuff, to translate what we had as demos, which was kind of like, they were good demos, like they were a clear idea of what the tune should be. But then when we went in with Ross, he was like able to turn it into something like very, especially the dance tunes, it was very, it was like an extra bit of magic kind of thing. Like the things that he could do with the sequencer and stuff like that is like no idea that how anyone would do something like that. And like, so it gives you an extra palette to wear.
Awesome. What's an underrated skill you think every musician should have? So we've got a lot of young musicians listening to this. What's an underrated skill you think every musician should have? It doesn't have to be technical to do the instrument, or it can be. What's a skill you think every musician should have?
Being a musician is not like too technical. I mean, for some people probably is, but I like don't even know what half the chords are that I'm writing in. So I don't think it's, I think it can become too technical. Yeah, I think a strong team, you want your people that are very technical and knowledgeable about music and stuff like that. But I think it's mostly about your ears and recognising what you like and what you want. So I guess knowing your taste and, yeah, not getting too caught up in technicality, but music can be easy if you kind of use your ears and your intuition to tell you what sounds good or not.
Love it. Good advice. Let's talk about diversity and inclusion in the music industry. It's mainly cisgender males at the top of the industry, and that obviously needs to change, I would say. How, in your opinion, can we make the industry more diverse and inclusive?
Yeah, it's a big question, isn't it? I think, for a start, it would help if people booked things a bit more evenly, like all these things like the Key Change program where people are doing 50-50 splits on the lineups is great. It's only going to help. That's a big thing. I feel like the music industry is still, there's still quite a lot of, it's still kind of set up around lad indie bands a bit. I think there's kind of like that's kind of a vibe for a lot of the industry. And, like, I think the, obviously, like I said, the live bookings will help to change that, and the media around it. There's a lot of, like, good stuff out there to promote, so I think it's when the spotlight needs to be more on diverse members of the population that are making good music.
What specifically needs to, so in regards to that, so can you think of, you know, what else is the answer? Is it a case of the media giving more spotlight, more opportunity to people from diverse backgrounds, so that we get, you know, more representation of the UK? Yeah, I guess that's, you know, it's the media kind of focus, I guess.
Yeah, I think it'll change. I think it'll take a while to change the culture. Even like the stuff, like, I think I see, like, going to watch a band is like, it's starting to become more of a thing that, like, a group of girls will do, but it's not something in the past really that, for, you know, you'd get like lads going with the girlfriend or a mixed group, but there's a lot of, like, lads that'll go out and watch a band together, and it's all lads and that kind of thing. And I think there's also making the spaces safe for women, and making women feel safe when they go to a gig. And I'd like it to be more of, there to be more of a culture where girls go together to watch a band. And I think there is. I think that is changing with young people, but there's just so many elements to it. I don't think there's any easy answer to changing it. I think getting more girls being in bands, getting more people playing music, is a start as well.
Yeah, I think women feeling safe, gigs is a big issue. And I know a very high profile gig only a few days ago that I know someone who was at, who said that they didn't feel particularly comfortable or safe in the environment they were in. So that needs to change as well. Is the music industry, and if you were the leader of the music industry, what laws would you create to make the music industry more fair?
Well, I would change the streaming situation. I think everything that's been, the Broken Record campaign has been spot on. And then I think that's come out recently, hasn't it, that the recommendations are that it needs a complete reset, which I'd change that tomorrow, definitely, yeah. It is hard because so much of music making does depend on live music. Obviously, the shift in how musicians make income has gone a lot onto live music. So, yeah, that would make a big difference. And maybe people wouldn't all be scrambling over getting dates to play live shows. We wouldn't all be lugging so much gear around everywhere all the time. Not that I'm complaining about playing live shows, because I do love being touring and being on the road and stuff. But I think there is too much of a dependence on live music, maybe, and the streaming side would help. And it's quite a uncertain kind of job. You can't tell what's going to happen in the future. So I think if we did change the streaming stuff, that would help a little bit with a bit more security.
When you are going on tour, which is going to be happening soon, how do you select the songs for set lists with such a kind of growing body of work?
Yeah, it just puts you in a better position because you've just got more to go from. So you, like, when you're first starting, it's like you got to play everything, and then going forward you're like, oh, this gives me so many more options. Like, you start to play a little bit longer, but you can really hone it down to your best stuff. And like, now we're in a really strong position that we've got to, like, cut things that we maybe didn't want to cut and stuff. But like, I just want to, like, play the whole new album, really, but we can't really do that. So we'll play a lot of stuff from the new album, but obviously we'll play a lot of old stuff as well. And yeah, just everything that we know goes down well live, and just selecting the best, really.
Amazing. So Louise has got a tour coming up in October 2021 in Blackpool, Leeds, Newcastle, Glasgow, Reading, Bristol, Portsmouth, London, Leicester, Birmingham, Manchester and Liverpool. That's going to be a good night, the night in Liverpool. We'll begin to wrap up. How should we finish up here? Obviously you've given loads of great advice on this podcast for young musicians, both today and in the previous episode. What's the best bit of advice someone's given you? It's the Rolodex of stuff that you're getting now that you think, no, I can't say that.
I think maybe like when in the past, when I've been like worried about like speaking on stuff or like doing interviews or like what people are going to think and stuff like that, I think the best advice has just been, I think what James Skelly said to me was like, as soon as you've done it, it's gone. Don't like linger on it. Don't worry about anything like that. It's the past. It's just gone. So don't worry about it. Don't dwell on anything that's out there in social media, because I think social media is like, can be quite like consuming for, there is a lot of pressure to like do another post or promote what you've got. You've got to like promote yourself as well, haven't you? So I think social media can become a bit consuming. So I think what you've got to do is kind of like, do what you do, move on, and try and not dwell on it.
Great advice, actually, particularly in this age. Okay, last two questions. What's the longest you've gone without writing a song? Because it's interesting you said that you're not writing at the moment. And that's really interesting to me because this album is so prolific. And you said, I only wrote kind of 12 songs for it, and like pretty much all of them on the album. And then, you know, if you compare that Tom York, Damon Albarn in the past have said like, you know, they write a song a day kind of thing just to keep them going. And how do you ever feel apprehension about the fact that you're having gaps in your writing and thinking, oh, I might be missing songs, or have you got, you know, are you kind of filing stuff away for later on? Like, what's the longest you've gone, and how do you feel in that kind of down period of not writing?
I think I've gone quite a long time, like months and months. I feel like I kind of do it in cycles, so it's like there's a writing cycle, and then I can stop and carry on with life, and then I'll go into another writing cycle at some point. I don't know if that's kind of half just like, thank God I've got that done, and I'll just let myself have a bit of time off. But I know what you, it's like, I've definitely felt like, oh no, I don't know where the next song's going to come from. What am I like, I think I've forgotten how to do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I felt like, I think coming up to this album, I was like, I don't know if I've got it anymore. I don't know if I can write anymore. And then once you do it again, it's like, okay, yeah, I can. Remember how to do this. But there's always that like little tiny demon that's like, where's your next song going to come from then? Do you know what I mean? So, but I think I've had enough experience of going, that demon's so wrong, because I can do it if I need to. So,
great. Great to hear. Okay, so the final question, this is the one that I reckon most people will be tuning in for. What's Mark Lawrenson like, and how happy were you with the predictions that you had in the Premier League this weekend on BBC?
Well, I didn't actually meet him. So damn. I tweeted him and he didn't reply. So that's all you really need to know.
That's a peek behind the wizard's curtain there, isn't it? Okay.
But I did actually beat him on the predictions, so... I think I beat him by 20 points. So,
because you got Everton and Liverpool score absolutely spot on, which is your club and his club, which is really interesting. Wow.
Yeah, well, they're the two clubs that I actually watch the most, to be honest. But I suppose there's a little bit of luck. There's always a little bit of luck involved with predictions, but they're the two clubs that I watch, because I watch Everton and then I watch Liverpool because my partner's a Liverpool fan,
and works at Liverpool, right?
And she works at Liverpool, as well. Yeah. She works at the foundation, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I also like support whoever Liverpool are playing against as well. So,
Well, well done. You got those two predictions spot on, which is very impressive. This will wrap up there. Thank you so much, Louisa, again, for sharing your incredible mind with our listeners. You're truly, you know, a very, very special talent at the peak of your powers, and we really appreciate you coming on. Good luck with the tour. Good luck with the album release. Love to Dawn, and thanks for being such a great returning guest on the Stage Chef podcast.
Nice one. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers, Louisa. Catch you later.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
This episode was scored, mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4 month old. He's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.
Press subscribe and you'll get more episodes with members of Kraftwerk, Radiohead, Fleet Mac, and Guns N' Roses.